Honourable members, can we please come to order? Including honourable members who are conducting conversations on their cell phones and... Thank you. Advocate Potier, welcome. Advocate Potier and the Catholic Bishops Conference are regular visitors to Parliament, so he's no stranger to us. Please.
Thank you, Chairperson. Good afternoon to the honourable members. We are regular visitors and we make submissions before most of the parliamentary committees. It may seem a bit strange, though, to some members that the Catholic Bishops' Conference comes along on the occasion of what is in some ways a very technical piece of constitutional legislation. And I think that we do so because it has the potential either to promote and uphold or otherwise to threaten judicial independence. And along with the rest of civil society, we hold the independence of the judiciary as an extremely high constitutional value. And that's why we wanted to have a brief say on this legislation. I listened to the two submissions made this morning, and I'm certainly not going to get into that level of, you can tell this from my written submission, we're not going to get into that level of detail. It seems to me that the committee and then Parliament must simply decide, is it desirable in the constitutional scheme that governs the judiciary to have a minimum term of office for the Chief Justice and the President of the Supreme Court of Appeal? And if the answer to that question is yes, it is desirable, then the subsidiary questions are how long should that minimum term be, and how do we achieve it most efficiently and with the necessary safeguards, etc. If the answer is no, well then a lot of the arguments simply fall away, and it seems to me that then the term of office of the present Chief Justice will simply come to an end in a couple of weeks' time. We submit that it is desirable that both of those offices should have tenure. Stability, continuity, leadership, the time that it takes for someone to settle into the leadership of an organization, all of those things suggest that to chop and change every few years, 2 years, 3 years, 4 years, or whatever, is not a good idea. And perhaps in the immediate history of our constitutional court, there's evidence for that. We've had three justices so far. The sitting one, Chief Justices, the sitting one has only been there for 2 years. So for the previous 15 years, we had two Chief Justices, and I think that did give us stability and continuity and all of those good things. It just happened that way because of their ages, but it worked out well. And so we suggest that that is a good idea and that a way should be found to accommodate that. The question was asked earlier this morning, why 7 years, why not some other total? Well, in a sense it is arbitrary. But any kind of limit or cut-off is arbitrary. The original idea of a 12-year term for a constitutional court judge was arbitrary. It could have been 10, could have been 15. It is now 15 in certain cases. Ruling that all judges must cease active service at the age of 75 is also arbitrary. There's any number of people older than that who would be excellent on the bench. And in many other jurisdictions, the US Supreme Court, for example, they can continue for as long as they like. So these cut-offs, by their nature, are not defensible on some great big objective grounds. You've got to plump for a number and then sort of stick with it. And 7 years certainly is not too short a time for a Chief Justice or a President of the SCA to do all of the things that we heard about earlier, to transform things, to set the court right, to put his or her footprint on the jurisprudence of their court. At the same time, hopefully, it's not so long that irreparable damage can be done by someone who proves to be not entirely up to the job. It's not a lifetime tenure. So 7 years seems to be enough. If I can move just beyond what's in our written submission to deal with a couple of the points that were raised this morning, or to make comment on them, is this ad hominem legislation. I think that there's a general consensus that one should shy away from ad hominem legislation unless it becomes absolutely indispensable to do so. I don't believe that this is, strictly speaking, ad hominem, and for two reasons. Firstly, it is not being introduced only to accommodate the Chief Justice or the head of the Constitutional Court. It applies equally to the President of the Supreme Court of Appeal. So immediately it's moving away from any one individual judge, and it's applying to at least to two judges. Secondly, it's not, if it is adopted, as the years roll by, it's not something that is only going to be applicable to one single identifiable individual. It's going to be applicable to whoever ends up holding those two offices. It would be naive, I suppose, to pretend that this has come before the committee with no reference at all to the present Chief Justice. Obviously, that is what has prompted it. But I think there's a difference between legislation which is enacted in order to accommodate a single identifiable individual, truly ad hominem legislation, and on the other hand, legislation which has been prompted or brought to the fore because of an anomalous situation or a particular situation which has arisen. So I don't think that the committee needs to worry too much about an accusation that it is being asked to pass ad hominem legislation. There was also discussion about the question of the constitutionality of constitutional court judges being treated differently from others, and in particular the Chief Justice being treated differently in the sense of being given tenure where the other Concord judges are not. Again, I don't see that that is a serious problem. The Constitution treats all sorts of office bearers and office holders differently from others. It has particular provisions, for example, around the Speaker of the National Assembly, where it doesn't treat other MPs in a similar way. It says the President of the Republic can only have two terms of office, but it doesn't say that about the Deputy President or any Cabinet Minister, for example, in other words, senior members of the Executive. So there's a number of ways in which the Constitution deals with particular office holders differently from others. And so in principle, if this piece of legislation, in trying to give effect, in a sense, to a constitutional exception, ends up treating the Chief Justice, the head of the Concord, differently from other Concord judges, I don't see that that is a particular problem. Certainly there's an objective reason for it. There's a justifiable reason for it, and that is what we heard all about his present and his probably forthcoming duties as head of the overall judiciary, etc., etc. Lastly, on this point, the matter was raised, but what about the situation where you have someone appointed chief in the 15th year of service as a Concord judge, and that person then ends up, if they're young enough, serving a further 7 years. You can have someone then sitting 22 years as a Constitutional Court judge. I suppose that that's theoretically possible, and the subtext to that question is the fear that you would then get a very executive-minded person in the post. Professor Calland answered that to some extent by referring to the fact that until that person is Chief Justice, he or she is only one of 11. Even after that, they're only one of 11, albeit the Chief. But it raises for me also a different consideration, and that is the way in which the Chief Justice is actually selected and appointed. And perhaps if there's a legitimate fear that a poor Chief Justice, or one who does some sort of damage to the Constitution or to the rule of law or whatever, an undesirable person, ends up in that position, then Parliament perhaps needs to look at the way in which the Chief Justice is selected in the first place. Such a person will have had a track record already of however many years it is that they've served on the Concord or in other capacities. And if someone were to be brought in from outside the Concord and made Chief Justice, which is obviously possible, then you might be picking up a problem, and maybe that's something that Parliament needs to look at, rather than try to accommodate that at the other end of the legislative system, at the end where you're dealing with granting tenure. The main part of our submission is not to do with those provisions, which, as I say, we broadly support, but rather this question of the mechanism of discharge. I didn't know when I wrote the submission that Professor De Vos had written on this. I very seldom see his blog. I also didn't know that Professor Calland was mentioning it. Why has it not come up in the last 10 years? I've got no idea why we didn't spot it 10 years ago and why it hasn't been dealt with in the interim. But then the matter that is occupying you in terms of Section 8A and B also wasn't really spotted for the last 10 years. So that's not really surprising. I think that the written submission is fairly clear. The discretion that is given to the President of the Republic to discharge is problematic because it would be very difficult to exclude speculation or perception about a political motive from such a discharge. Now, clearly the intention is that the kind of scenario where you have a judge who's injured in a car accident or is diagnosed with some sort of medical condition or whatever, which makes it objectively difficult or impossible for that judge to continue, and there must be a means for relieving that judge of his office. And I suppose in 99 times out of 100 the request would come initially from the judge himself or herself. But what happens in a scenario where the president elects to discharge a judge who has held frequently against the government? How is it possible then, on some basis, the judge has had memory lapses or has turned up in court one day very, very forgetful or just a bit out of it or something, and the president forms the opinion that this is the early onset of Alzheimer's or something like that. How are you then going to avoid a situation where people speculate? And conversely, what happens when a judge who has held often against the government is truly becoming incapable of carrying on, and the president says, hang on, if I just discharge in terms of 8C, I'm going to be accused of getting rid of an uncomfortable judge and I'm not going to do it, and on that basis then an incompetent or incapable judge continues on the bench. All that we're suggesting is that all of that unpleasantness and confusion and speculation can be very easily avoided if you simply add in before the words "be discharged by the President," words to the effect of "upon recommendation by the Judicial Services Commission." I don't think that there should be any confusion between the difference between removal and discharge. The constitutional provision 177 deals with the uncomfortable situation where a judge has to be removed because basically he or she has done something wrong and it's necessary to remove. The JSC steps in, makes a recommendation to Parliament. Well, you do the same sort of thing, except that the initial cause would be an innocent matter rather than an impropriety or something like that. And it would then remove any possible inference about political motivation or interference, and it would safeguard and uphold the independence of the judiciary. Chairperson, that is really the sum total of our submissions. Thank you.
Thank you. Right. The Honourable John Jeffrey, followed by the Honourable Steve Swart, and then the Honourable Dean Smuts.
Chair, thanks. I'm just going to restrict it to four. What's it? 8C. And I think your suggestion about making it upon recommendation of the JSC is a good one, because look, if you didn't have C, you would then have a problem of a judge has a stroke, whatever, and they've got to go through this long contorted process as provided for by 177, and that's removal, not discharge. They haven't done anything to deserve being fired, which is what removal is. They're just sent off onto early retirement. And then you also have, you know, if you followed the De Vos route of removing that section because it's so patently unconstitutional, you then have a problem about you've taken away the ability of the Chief Justice to say, look, I've had enough, I want to be discharged, the point two element. So I think your proposal deals with that, because point two, Chair, is the where the Chief Justice or the head of the Supreme Court of Appeal requests the President to relieve him or her. So I like that. I think the issue would be what you then suggest we do with the other section, which relates only to constitutional court judges, which, you know, nobody, including all the second year constitutional law students, noticed, and their professors actually, and that is that so it's section 3 of the judge's remuneration, 3(2)(c), may at any charge be discharged. We could leave it as it is, because nobody's sort of actually said anything about that, or we could do the same and make it upon the recommendation of the JSC. I don't know what happens to other judges, how they are dealt with when they go, you know, start having problems. I don't know if anybody from the department can tell us. But anyway, Chair, basically, I agree with the Catholic Bishops Conference amendment to see. I think rather than scrapping the whole thing, it does fulfil a purpose. Okay. I'm told it's, what bill is this? Oh, okay. No, it's apparently no.
3(1)(b).
No, but oh yeah, okay. That's judges and judges from service. Yeah. Okay, so it covers all judges. But yeah, it would be basically, so I agree with you on your proposal on clause 8, 8(2). But what do you suggest we do as far as section 3(2)(c) of the bill? Put in the same wording, or just leave it as it is because nobody brought it to us?
Okay, can I respond very quickly to that? I think it's 3(1)(b). And 3(2)(c) of the Principal Act. 3(1)(b) dealing with constitutional court judges and 3(2)(c) with ordinary judges. And I would suggest that again, the addition of the same few words would solve that problem. As I've said in my submission, 8(c) mirrors. Yeah. And the wording has been taken straight from 3(1)(c).
You actually don't need C yet.
The Chief Justice is the head of the Constitutional Court, so you don't need C for them,
right.
But you need it for the head of the SCA.
Well, then take out
unless
the Chief
Justice. Unless you amend 3. Unless you amend 3(1)(c) and 3(1)(b) and 3(2)(c), and then because they'll either be an ordinary judge or a Constitutional Court judge. They don't need, you don't need 8(c). Maybe through you to the Catholic Bishops, what about that?
You could achieve it by scrapping 8(c) entirely and
yes.
Then amending 3(1)(b). Well, you could simply say 3(1)(a), a constitutional court judge, including the Chief Justice, and then it flows from that and then when you get to 3(1)(c), you add in, upon recommendation by the Judicial Service Commission. 3(1)(b), sorry, yes.
But he wants to include the President of the SCA as well.
Yeah, that would come under 3(1)(2), Chair.
Okay.
That would, a judge who holds office in a permanent capacity, including the President of the Supreme Court of Appeal.
I don't want to start getting quirky on words, but the Chief Justice will always be the head of the Constitutional Court. So he will or she will always be a constitutional court judge. Do you need to say at the start of 3(1) a constitutional court judge including the Chief Justice? Because it's covered. And then similarly for 3(2), the Supreme Court of head of the Supreme Court of Appeal is a judge. So they would be covered by 2. You don't have to put a judge who holds office in a permanent capacity including the Chief Justice of the SCA. Why have you then left off the Deputy Chief Justice, etc., etc.? So I think, just discussing it with you, would the solution simply not be just to amend 1(b), put in the words upon the recommendation of the Judicial Services Commission, and amend 2(c) with those same words and scrap 8(c).
well.
You're basically saying the same thing, it's just a question of whether you have to specifically refer to the Chief Justice and the President of the SEA.
I don't suppose one absolutely has to refer to those two. I think it would perhaps assist with clarity. It would see 8A and B in the bill single out the Chief Justice and the President of the SEA for, in a sense, special treatment, different treatment, tenures them, etc. Mr. Jeffrey is quite correct that on a strict reading, as he proposes, of Section 3, it refers in 1 to all Constitutional Court judges and in sub 2 to all other judges. But I would suggest for absolute clarity there'd be no harm in singling out those two, being the only two judges in the country that are given 7-year tenure. Singling them out, you could leave it in 8C, it would be clear enough there. I don't think it does any harm. It's repetitious to an extent, but it doesn't do any harm.
So, Chair, just through you, sorry, then it would be keep 8C with your amendment, because that is the section dealing with the minimum period of active service.
Yes.
So you keep it there, and then you just simply add those similar words upon the recommendation for the Constitutional Court judges in 3.1B and ordinary judges in 3.2C.
Correct. That's what I would go with that, yes.
The Honourable Dean Smuts, followed by Steve Swart, followed by Dr. Ambrosini.
Chair, now having listened to all of that, tell me what the difference is between infirmity and incapacity, because I have always understood incapacity to mean that you are incapacitated, and the Constitution tells you how you remove a judge, not just for misconduct, not just for incompetence, but also for incapacity. And the Judicial Services Commission, under its Amendment Act, has a system now for dealing with misconduct charges which serve before a tribunal. I don't think there's anything in that Amendment Act that deals with incompetence or incapacity. But what is the difference between infirmity and incapacity? If failing any difference, I think we must stick with the constitutional provision. And the second question to Mike Bothier, please. Why, and well, to the drafters, I guess, as well, why are we dealing with the President of the SCA? Your argument now, sir, was that it was makes sense to give them a good term of 7 years, both, because of the you want them there for a while and to establish themselves, and it's an important job. But the one job exceeds the other, and the Chief Justice is going to be the head of the entire judiciary in South Africa, including the magistracy. He's not the Chief Justice just of the entity on Constitution Hill, which is so well funded. He's the Chief Justice of everybody, including the High Courts, the Regional Courts, all of the courts. That's the big job. That's the job that you want to give a decent term of office to. Surely it's not the same thing with the President of the SCA. I mean, the Appeal Court remains enormously important. Sometimes I ask myself whether that shouldn't be turned into the Apex Court. But it's they are of unequal weight. Is there really a good reason why we've got the President of the SCA in here? It was in the old 8, but it doesn't follow that it must come into the amendment bill.
Steve Swart.
I just wanted to touch on the, going back to the central issues that we were dealing with this morning, and the 176.1, it appears from your submission, you didn't go into a lot of detail, but that you don't have a problem with that exception, except when Act of Parliament, and you would think that we are quite able, and you've also argued that you would also think that the equality argument is not applicable here. You've said the CJ is a particular office, and I think we would tend to agree with you. But what happens if the court comes out and finds against that? Do we then fall back to the 15-year period across the board? What would you suggest on that? And I do appreciate you said you didn't go into a lot of detail on that. But firstly, this morning it was argued this exception shouldn't really apply, but it seems that you, 176.1, you don't have a problem with that. Then just also the issue of a person in their 15th year been then appointed as Chief Justice for 7 years. Now, bearing in mind when we started, it was a very limited period. The idea of the Constitutional Court being on bank for a limited period to prevent becoming politically minded, is that not quite a serious consideration? 22 years in total, then. Thank you.
Dr. Emerson.
Repeat myself. The order I during the lunch, and I think this presentation is comes at the right time as far as I'm concerned. I was seized with the issue of the word extend. I mean, and it is a matter of details. We must look at the details, and so those who engage us, because that's where we stand or fall constitutionally. It is 12 years. The Constitution says 12 years not renewable. It doesn't say unless Parliament provides otherwise, unless an act of Parliament provides otherwise, as John was highlighting yesterday. Unless an act of Parliament extends the term of office. Now, it seems that the difference, and this the thought was came to my mind, that the difference between extending a term of office and providing for a different term of office lies in the fact that the term of office must already exist, must be in existence, so you can extend it. And if that is correct, you could not extend a term of office which hasn't started yet. And if that is correct, this act of Parliament contemplated by 176(1) cannot provide for future terms of offices. And that is not sure where the presenter has a view on the matter. Then correctly in the debate we are having, Mr. Chairman, we are anticipating some of what we will be discussing when seized with the Constitutional Amendment Bill. But we are really dealing with what does the Constitution is present for means. And if we were to provide otherwise, how do we, what are the values and what are the principles? And I think the presentation raised that point. I, for one, and I'd like to put this to the presenter, beg to differ. Beg to differ because I believe that there is a fundamental difference between constitutional adjudication under a long constitution which contains programmatic provisions and the ordinary job of administering justice, ensuring the uniform application of the legal system, applying the legal syllogism. And I think that the purpose of having short terms of offices is exactly to ensure in this country, as in all the other countries which I know of in which there is constitutional adjudication, that there is that renewal, because it is not an exclusively technical job. Constitutional adjudication, it's a policy job on the boundary of politics, is that of developed constitutional policies. Now it's time to give antiretroviral drugs. Now it's time to give housing as a right. Now it's time to deal with a new threat to human rights violations. Now it's time to find things under the penumbra of a right, etc., etc. And if that is the principle that we're dealing with, would we not be countering that principle by giving a 7-year blanket exemption, a blanket extension, in addition to the fact that that 7-year blanket would be unconstitutional if my interpretation of the word extend is in fact correct, that we cannot legislate about that which has not yet been, which is not yet in place. Thank you.
Okay, I think that I dealt with Mr. Jeffrey's points, I think, in exchange there. the difference between infirmity and incapacity, it seems to me simply that incapacity is a more drastic and more serious circumstance. You're incapable of carrying out a certain office. If you're infirm, it might be increasingly difficult, you might not be completely up to it, etc., etc. One can envisage, for example, a situation where a particular judge is unable to sit in the ordinary course of long criminal trials or something like that, but is quite capable of hearing short applications or whatever. I can envisage a situation where a judge is physically incapable of going out on in loco inspections, but quite capable of sitting in a courtroom. So infirmities would come in, and I think it's at that sort of point where you want, with, there is perhaps a need for a certain discretion. Having said that, I do quite see the force of the argument that why not just leave it all in terms of 177? Yeah. And wherever it appears that there is a problem with a judge continuing in office, leave it to the JSC. I assume that the JSC responds either to a request from a judge, from the person concerned, or a request from the head of the particular court concerned, or in a sense a complaint or whatever from anybody else. And I assume that that's all dealt with in other legislation, regulation, and so on.
Sorry, can I just ask on that? I mean, there is a difference between incompetence and misconduct, which leads to removal, which is you are fired, and discharge, which is basically you're not fired, but you're basically booked off sick. You haven't done anything wrong, but you can't carry on, and presumably there are pension differences. Now, if you want to keep 177, you basically then mean every judge who has a stroke, is just physically not able to do it, and who doesn't ask for it themselves, and sometimes you do get some people who don't want to admit it, then there has to be, not just that the JSC isn't the problem, the problem in 177 is what else is there. And that is that you also then have to get the support of the National Assembly by a vote of two-thirds, which is quite onerous, which is necessary to deal with a judge who's being threatened with removal because of misconduct, but not at all necessary when it comes to an issue of incapacity. But I think the other key thing for not leaving it, I mean, this is now in response to Dean's point, making a distinction between removal and discharge, is that there are different benefits which accrue.
Can I say the same way John jumped in? I hope you allow me to. Thank you. See, before you answer, sir.
It's on the same issue, eh?
Yes. We are not dealing with any infirmity. We are dealing with an infirmity which renders him incapable. It's an infirmity which renders him incapable in terms of 8.3 sub 1. So, from a language viewpoint, I cannot understand the difference between an infirmity which renders him incapable and the incapacity referred to in 177. Linguistically, it's the same. And linguistically, it supports the thing that incapacity has a broader semantic area and infirmity has a smaller semantic area. One is a category of the other. Hence, the issue of constitutionality raised earlier.
I would have to agree with that. Now that one looks again at 3.1b, for example, or the 8c, an infirmity which renders you incapable is in plain English simply an incapacity.
Incapacity, yeah.
The key difference, though, and I agree with Mr. Jeffrey, the whole scheme of Section 177 of removal is suggestive of somebody who has to be removed more or less against his or her will. It's not a judge who's come along and said, look, I can't do the job anymore. I've had this terrible stroke or whatever. It's removal, which is a much more sort of active intervention from outside. That's what that verb suggests to me anyway. it could have been perhaps better drafted, or the relationship between removal and discharge could have been thought through a little bit more clearly. But that there may be times when a judge, for the most innocent of reasons, becomes incapable and needs to be discharged in what in the military would be called an honorable discharge. And where pension benefits may kick in and all the rest of it is something that possibly needs to be accommodated somehow. Whether it needs to be accommodated in this bill or in 177, I don't know. But certainly the two are not in accord linguistically at the moment.
Okay. John Jeffrey and then Debbie Schaefer.
Yeah, I hear that, but I do think that there's a need for both scenarios. Removal, which is provided for in the Constitution, and then discharge where they're not able to do it. There is maybe some, 177 is a finding by the JSC that the judge suffers from an incapacity, so it could be any incapacity, it's not a permanent incapacity. And then you've got to have this National Assembly two-thirds vote. There may be cases where, which are covered by Section 3 of the existing Act at the moment. I mean, let's say the judge, if the judge asks to be discharged, that's fine. That's covered, that's much easier, you don't have to go through the JSC. But it would not be unusual or abnormal for a judge to be in a permanent coma from a car crash or to have suffered a stroke where they cannot ask. Okay. Now, if you do away with three, aside from the consequences issue of the difference between discharge and removal, are you then going to, a judge has a stroke, he is or she is on life support systems in the hospital. Now, to actually discharge them, or remove them, because that's the word in the Constitution, you've got to have the JSC involved, then you've got to bring it to Parliament and have a two-thirds vote to say, Judge X, who is lying in a coma, we support their, it would have to be removal, because that's what the Constitution talks about. So that's why I think we do need, I hear the problems of language, but I do think we need to provide for both eventualities. And I think the issue really is that, and this is almost a sort of mini sideshow, let's not get too caught up in it. I think if we don't have amendments to Section 3, so we could simply just leave it as it is. We could delete 8C on the basis that, well, they're covered anyway by 3, which then may be the safest option. And we then deal with, because it just seems that the Constitution shouldn't just provide for removal, but should also provide for discharge, which is different. So I'm just raising that as a possible other option. Leave 3 as it is, with all its problems, Section 3. Delete 8C, because problems have been raised with it, and in any event, it's covered not by 177, as the Honourable, or as Professor DeFosse says, but it's covered by Section 3.
That was the goal. Debbie?
Thanks, Mr. Chair. I don't know why Honourable Jeffrey is so captivated by submissions that aren't before this committee, but anyway. I also have a concern with people who aren't able to. I think maybe we need to make a distinction between people who want to be discharged and who actually ask to be discharged. Then the President can perhaps do it on their request. No.
Yeah.
Oh, all right. Okay, but I mean, you know, the situation also, I'm also concerned about the situation where they can't actually ask, or they don't know they're supposed to ask. What if they're going stark raving mad, but they don't think they are? You know, seriously. I mean, they're not going to come and ask, and then you can, or maybe they're not, and the President thinks they are.
Well, shouldn't you then go for
removal?
That's not removal. He could say you've got a permanent infirmity of mind, and I think that's where the problem comes in.
Shouldn't we then follow the route of the ad hoc committee, because then it's a judicial, what do they call it, judicially unsound of mind or something like that?
Anyway, can I finish my point, please?
Yes.
Thank you. I just think we need some kind of objective assessment of particularly infirmities of mind, because I don't think that should be left up to the President's discretion only.
To just point out to Debbie that the proposal from Catholic bishops is not to in the 8 that is before us, clause 8, is to make it upon the recommendation of the JSC.
So
that one is fine. The difficulty is that you can't really amend 8C and leave section 3 as it is, because you've then got an inconsistency between the two.
Okay.
Hence, I think there's probably general agreement on the issue. It's more just how to deal with it, and it's then a question of, do you just summa leave section 3 as is, because nobody made submissions on it. It's not part of the amendment bill. No. Delete 8C, because then it's covered by section 3. Otherwise, I think the option to me, notwithstanding Dr. Ambrosini's concerns about the wording, would be keep 8C with the Catholic Bishops amendment. It's on the recommendation of the JSC, and then amend 3.1b and 3.2c to also make them on the recommendation of the JSC.
As a rider, we could keep CII, because the entire problem is with CI.
There's no problem with CII. That's the one about the request, where they request their removal. You need that so that if the Chief Justice decides...
C2.
It's just the Roman reads it as II, not
it's an
two.
Italian issue.
It's Roman.
It's a Roman two.
Yes.
You know, when I refer to Latin, I've been accused of referring to Latin. When I don't.
I mean. That's called Roman, not...
All right. Sorry, JJ.
I think that that would be basically the proposal on that, but then the 8, so we keep 8C.
Yes.
With the change to 1.
Right.
Roman numeral 1. And we keep the Catholic bishops are suggested upon the recommendation of the JSC. I don't think it needs to be a finding, because the JSC will discuss it. It's largely going to be a factual issue. So it's unlike incompetence or anything like that.
All right.
It's quite a value judgment thing, were they incompetent or not. It's a factual thing. Have they got a permanent infirmity of mind? And if they want to challenge it, if somebody wants to challenge it, there's more than enough time for somebody to run to court to do it, while the JSC are considering it or whatever. But it's a check and balance on the President. And then 2 is necessary if the Chief Justice or any of these other judges decide, I've had enough, I want to go, that they can just request it.
I haven't forgotten that there are other questions that I didn't get to. Before I get there, Section 3 of the Principal Act is before you for amendment, not that provision, obviously, but just to create concord, if that is the correct expression, with your amendments to Section 8. I would think that if 3 is before you, then you can tamper with it as you like to create concord with whatever you decide to do with it. Thank you. Right. And if, for me, the important thing is that whether it is the removal or the discharge at the behest of the judge concerned, or the discharge of the comatose judge who needs to be honorably discharged, whatever the reason is for ending that judge's term of office, it must be done in a way, by a mechanism that precludes accusations of political interference, and that is to bring the JSC into the position. I did initially think that I would submit to you that the JSC should also receive the request. In other words, a judge who says, I can't carry on, I'm too old and tired now, should make that request through the JSC to the President.
Okay.
But I won't take that any further. I don't know why you are dealing with the President of the SCA as well as the Chief Justice position, but I'm sure that the drafters or somebody else could enlighten us on that.
I think they were both in 8, and that is why we just repeated what was in 8 as is.
In the principle, actually.
And that is good.
The SEA one is only chair where it's only an age-related thing. It's an issue where you've got, because they don't have a term problem that the constitutional court judges have. The one that we've got with Judge Norbor being 58 and many years to go. The SEA provision would only apply to a 70-year-old, as far as I can see it.
Okay.
So it's where you because there's no term limit, that's the only term limit, 70. So it's basically a provision to allow a person older than 70 but below the age of 75 to continue as president of the SEA. And it's a question of, I don't know if Dean is being unduly ageist. I don't have any particular affinity to 70-year-olds or 75-year-olds, but that's what that's the only time it's used for.
Yeah.
And I suppose the issue would be if you've got a very active, spry 69-year-old who's now going to be lost forever, then you can extend their term, that basically.
Maybe both should be filed.
I think the argument of the ad hominem legislation, I mean, it was clearly indicated that it cannot be regarded as such because we're dealing with the Chief Justice as well as the President. We're not dealing with a single person.
Eight existing, we're now discussing now the bill, but my gut feeling would be 8 provides the existing Section 8 of the judge's remuneration, provides for an extension of the term of office of the President of the Supreme Court of Appeal. That is done by the President, okay, which was part of the objections. But seeing it already provides for the extension of the President of the Supreme Court of Appeal, why don't we keep the amendment removing the President's discretion that allows them to remain until 75?
Where's the
question
that
he was Chief Justice and he retired.
Yes, but does that mean he retired at 70? How long ago did Justice retire? That's longer ago than it's longer ago.
The question just is, for what reason is this President regarded in the same way as the Chief Justice, given that the Chief Justice is the head of the entire judiciary?
Well, I think the answer was that Section 8 deals with both. Well, that's something they must answer. Mr. Skusana, you wanted to respond?
No, I'm not responding.
Oh.
I'm putting a further complication.
Oh, okay. That helps us.
Because if a judge who has been 15 is appointed on his 15th year, as a president of the SCA, despite the fact that he has come 15 years in terms of the session, may be required to stay for 7 years beyond the 15 years.
Sorry, the head of the SCA isn't limited to the 15-year term.
No. It's limited to a 70-year age.
Yes. Okay.
Yes.
So I'm not sure about the 15 years.
No, I'm saying, in terms of current dispensation, any judge, including the SCA judge, who has completed 15 years and has completed 65 years,
65.
Yes, 65 years is entitled to be discharged from active service.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Now, I'm saying this, the impact of this section is that any judge, despite the fact that is 65 and despite the fact that it's completed 15 years, this section has the impact of compelling the judge continue for a further period of 7 years.
38C is allows them the escape to get out. But I think what worries me is that the I must say I'm not so convinced by my own reasons. And that is that you know, you I'm not married to the president of the SCA.
I just mentioned though that there's nothing to force a particular judge from accepting appointment to head the SCA. If that person has served 15 years and was looking forward to retirement at the normal age, and the president says, I want you to head up the SCA, it's free for that person to say, well, thank you, but I'd rather not. And if you want to take on that honour and all the rest of it, then you do so in the knowledge that you're expected to serve 7 years.
Mm.
And if during the course of that 7 years you have good reason to ask to be discharged, then 8C2 exists to allow you to be discharged. So I wouldn't think that practically that's ever going to be a serious problem. Mr. Chair, may I refer to the other questions that were...
Please.
The question of whether the exception that was created by the Principal Act, and which is sort of sustained now in these amendments, has become the rule that is mentioned in 176.1. I certainly don't feel qualified to comment on that. And I don't think that it's the competence of the Bishops' Conference to comment on that sort of constitutional detail. All that I would say is that on an ordinary reading, when that constitutional amendment says, except where an Act of Parliament extends the term of office of a constitutional court judge, the plain meaning of that seems to me to be fairly clear, that amendment gave Parliament the authority to extend a term. And if it had been felt that somehow then created a situation where what was meant to be an exception could suddenly grow up and become a rule, well then that was needed to be dealt with at the time that the amendment was being discussed. So I can see, and I don't say this with any sense of disrespect, but I can see the kind of the academic argument that Professor Cullen was putting forward there, and I'm not going to comment on the argument, but for me that's something which must be gone into, if it needs to be gone into, by revisiting 176.1, and I don't think that this set of amendments really affects that in any particular way. The equality argument, I think I try to deal with that by saying that, well, you know, obviously if the Constitutional Court were to find that the equality of members of that court, and perhaps even the equality of members of the Supreme Court of Appeal, is such that to treat the head of those respective courts differently from the ordinary members of those courts, if that is the finding of the Concord, then that's the finding of the Concord. It's not my place to say that they would be wrong on that. I just wouldn't be able to really see in this context what the reason would be for finding that. The head of a body, the principal of a school, the chief executive of a corporation, the speaker of parliament, a bishop in the church, they are treated very, very differently for all sorts of objective reasons. By analogy, most ordinary priests in the Catholic Church tend to retire at about the age of 70. Bishops carry on until 75. Popes carry on until they drop dead. That's just how it is in our church. And lo and behold, other churches do it differently. So the fact that the head of the Constitutional Court should be required to serve a longer term, I don't see that affects equality at all. Similarly, what if the Constitutional Court rules that it must be a 15-year term across the board? Well, if that is what they rule, then that's what they rule. I think it would still be, obviously, be open. It would still be open to Parliament, though, to pass the necessary constitutional amendments if Parliament felt strongly enough about this. Well, I wouldn't think it would necessarily come to that at all. The question of that word extends. Can you extend a term of office which has not yet started? I think that is an important question, and one would need to think very carefully through the implications of that. One thought that comes to me as I sit here is that the phrase is extends the term of office of a constitutional court judge. Given that the Chief Justice, or as long as the Chief Justice is a constitutional court judge and is not someone brought in from outside the Crown Court, and that has been the case up until now, then it is that person's term, one could argue, one could read it as saying it is that person's term of as a constitutional court judge that is now being extended by a further 7 years by virtue of the fact that he or she has been promoted into the office of chief. One could read it that way. I think that would hold it together. Mm. However, if an outsider was brought into as Chief Justice who was not already serving a term on the Crown Court, then I think that Dr. Ambrosini's point might very well be a fatal one in that sense. There would be no question then of a term being extended. It would be a brand new term starting, and it would not be covered by...
And it would be 12 years.
Yes, ordinarily it would be 12 years, or even 15 if they'd not been a judge before. Then it would be a mess, I think, under those circumstances. And then you'd have to, if you wanted to solve that, you'd have to revisit that word extends, or that phrase extends the term of office. Because it does denote a pre-existing term. And I agree that with the point also about these relatively short or limited terms of office, 12 years or 15 years, being important because of the programmatic nature of the Constitution and the changing dynamics and so on. And I think that is a principle that most people, and certainly as far as the Church is competent on such matters, we would support the idea of these limited terms in the Crown Court. I just don't think that the provision to allow a Chief Justice what is in most cases going to be less than an extra 7 years really does much violence to that principle. I think in most instances we're going to find that minimum term of 7 years overlaps with the term of 12 or 15 years. It may extend it by a few, as in the present case. It's going to extend, in effect, the present Chief Justice's term of office by 5 years. It's not going to end up in someone running the show for 22 years. That's an unlikely scenario. So the fact that one Crown Court judge has his or her term effectively extended by a few years doesn't really do very much violence to the general idea that they should have limited terms and that there should be a fairly regular turnover of judges.
Yes, very useful. I must thank you because your input has elicited a fair amount of discussion. So once more, thanks to you, Advocate Potier, and to the Catholic Bishops' Conference.
Thank you very much, Chair, and to the members.
Thank you. Honourable members, the way forward. Honourable Jeffrey.
Chair, look, we've had the submissions.
We may want to have some discussion around what we think of them. But I think that as has been raised, it's going to be very difficult to finalize the bill if the Constitutional Court is going to make its decision and its reasons, hopefully. I mean, to make a decision without giving its reasons at the same time, but hopefully they will do both soon. In terms of the time span, we've got a session scheduled at the National Assembly for Tuesday next week, and then there's a session of the NCOP after that. And I think we need to proceed as though we don't know when the court exactly will make give its judgment, but we need to proceed, but bear that in mind. What I would therefore want to suggest is that we look at if maybe Mr. Skosana can check with the court when the judgment is likely.
We don't want a situation, for example, where this committee adopts a bill and then the court judgment comes out before Tuesday, and we actually can't do anything to the bill. We've then got to wait for it to be referred back to us by the House. So I think we would need to, we shouldn't finalise the bill as yet. We may need to be prepared to sit on Friday or Saturday or Monday even. But probably if judgment is coming out on Thursday, sitting on Friday or Saturday would be preferable, because Monday is the day before the plenary. And if there's something that's gone wrong, we may not then be able to sit. Or we may, it may be too late, sorry, it may be too late to sit to stop the plenary if all the avenues have been blocked. So that's the one proposal I'd really want to make, is that Mr. Skosana checks when the judgment is expected, but that we are prepared to meet on Friday
and or Saturday.
Friday or Saturday and Monday. Okay. Then as far as the content, I mean, I think that there seems to be a general, I'd want to put forward a proposal. And that is that, and it's very difficult because there are so many different legal interpretations. I mean, we've seen that. Should this be an ad hominem bill dealing with a specific situation? Generally, that's been objected to more widely, but some are in favour of that. And I would want to suggest for the way forward at the moment, if we largely keep clause A in the bill, sorry, clause 2 in the bill, that's the amendment to section 8, as is, with the amendment that the Catholic bishops have suggested to C1, which was the words upon the recommendation of the JSC, that we though also look at an amendment to section 4. I would argue it's consequential, because the whole issue revolves around what you can do in section 176 unless extended by an act of parliament, and that we look at amending section 4.1 of the judge's remuneration, which and abolish the division between the 12-year term for constitutional court judges who were judges before, the differential 12 years for them and 15 years for people who were not judges before. And we make it 15 years across the board. Okay? And
we're doing it on principle. It's problematic from the point of view of equality.
Okay.
Keep it on the
record. So basically that maybe an amendment to 4.1 is prepared, which will provide for a 15-year term for the Constitutional Court judge. And then there are other consequential amendments that have come up now on section 3, relating to the discharge that again came up arising from the examination of 8C. So that those are the amendments that are prepared. If, for example, we find when the Constitutional Court judgment comes out, there's a variety of things we can't second guess them that may happen. They might say that, look, there's no way the whole of 8 is section 8 and you cannot remedy 8. We then drop the amendments to clause, the amendments in clause 2 of the bill and just proceed with the amendments to clause 4 and the other consequential amendments. Mm-hmm. If we find that they say no, the Chief Justice and the head of the SCA can be treated differently and appear as though an amendment to section 8 would be possible, then we can proceed with that and drop the amendment to 4. And then obviously we would be looking more thoroughly and from a public point of view. A lot of points were raised earlier about the mishmash approach. I can't remember the wording used, but we would want to then look at
cleaning
a cleaner solution in the 17th Amendment and the Superior Courts Act, bill rather. But Chair, that's then a proposal that we, number one, we are prepared to meet on Friday and Saturday and Monday.
Right.
That we and then as far as content, we keep at this stage, we ask for an amendment from the department to clause 8. We keep it as it is, but just to 8C. We amend 4.1 to be 15 years only, and those consequential amendments to section 3.
Okay.
Can I just ask, we're sitting on Tuesday, are we bound by that because of the process? Is that how long that?
Chair, basically, look, I mean, that's a special sitting for this bill, but it's called because there's an existing sitting of the NCOP on the 4th. So it's to get the bill before then, before the NCOP for the 4th. And the problem with the following week is that August 9 is in the middle and there's no sessions scheduled. And I suppose technically you also have to allow for if the NCOP do want to propose an amendment to the bill, that the NA needs to come back. So that would be another reason for that timing.
Mr. Ambrosini, followed by Mr. Swart.
Thank you.
This is on the proposal, eh?
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Preliminary, yes, I'm available to meet any time which is required, consistently with the requirement of time in the ad hoc committee. Four members here are members of the same committee, so we need to be coordinated in that respect. Secondly, yes, I think we should wait for the Constitutional Court judgment, not to... For the plenary, but to finalize our deliberations. We are here implementing a provision of the Constitution, an Act of Parliament provided for by provision of the Constitution, which is being interpreted for the first and possible last time by the Constitutional Court. I mean, I think it would be ill-advised and extremely irrational for us not to take that submission into account of our deliberation. So our deliberation should not be closed until we have the time to receive and expeditiously study the Constitutional Court judgment. Three, I for one, Mr. Chairman, may feel like you all that we need to implement the Constitution. I have a cultural repulsion for ad hominem bill. But one is to do what the Constitution asks us to do. And the way I read the Constitution, it would seem that all we can do is to extend terms of offices which do exist, and we need to have an Act of Parliament to extend the term of office of a judge. I would wish to be wrong in that respect. That's why I think we need to have the judgment of the Constitutional Court. The difficulty, I do agree with the Honorable Smart, that we must ensure the uniformity of treatment of all the justices. It's done across the world. It's important. The Chief Justice ought to remain a primum inter pares. It is important to the dynamics of a collegial body. And it's the same, Mr. Chairman, if you had a different role in this committee that you have, we could not have the type of debates and vibrant inputs that we do have. But if we think that we have the power to extend it to 15 years, why don't we then have the power to extend it to 20 years, to 25 years, to 30 years? And if we do have that power, what does it make of the constitutional provision that must be 12 years not renewable? That's why I've got an enormous difficulty with anything but an ad hominem bill. We are now discussing, in terms of adopting legislation, the length of office of a term, the length of the term of office of justices against the constitutional backdrop and the international understanding that it should be one term, not renewable, untouchable. So that's again, we would need to wait for guidance from the Constitutional Court, and these are the difficulties I have. If we do proceed with this bill, Mr. Chairman, my point four, I do agree that we need to have the amendment to Section 4, and I would like to have some text so to be able to apply my mind. I think that 3I, as a 3C sub I, sub 1, I also be happy with that, must go. I cannot reconcile with Section 177. I think it's impermissible. I think C sub 2 can stay and as a matter of policy should stay because it is beyond what the Constitution provides. and addresses situations that should not have not been provided for the Constitution. I think we do have the latitude. Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Correct, please. Dr. Ambrosini is understanding. I do believe that the differential treatment of a Chief Justice or Chief Justices and other Constitutional Court judges is appropriate. All I was saying was, should the Court rule that in respect of Constitutional Court judges, everything must be done collectively and equally, we then use that principle, that ruling, to say that Section 4 is unconstitutional, therefore all judges get 15. So it's from that point of view that I work. If the Court does not do a ruling against the differential treatment, then I like the bill the way it is. Then we do the 8, which is so similar to the DA's second proposal on 14 June. So please just understand me. I'm not taking that particular position at all. I think they should be able to be differentially treated. Could I just add that in the strange event that the Court doesn't say an ad hominem is out of the question because it's not a law of general application, can we not have that really as a third option? Because we all together moved an ad hominem. Just in the event the Court doesn't say you can't have an ad hominem, it's yet another option.
Just a point of I want to clarify what I said against the correction of the Honourable's matter with your leave. Okay, if that's their position, my position, if I may express one, is in support of the principle of equal treatment amongst the Constitutional Court justices. It's a very important principle. It's a collegial body. In our system, the system is already skewed in giving the Chief Justice, the President of the Constitutional Court, a much more important role and status. At the end, the independence of mind of each of the justices not to have a subservient relationship with the presiding officer is very important. And every one of them should be able to write their own judgment and have an equal status and not have to defer to somebody who is made by legislation or by perception not one amongst peer, not a primum but a superior. And so in that case I would not wish to underscore differences between justices by having different terms of offices, because different terms of offices means different length of offices creates not only seniority in terms of who got there first, but a different notion of seniority in terms of who stays there longer. Steve.
I just wanted to ask, would Dr. Ambrosini then be wanting an amendment to the to ensure that all judges are paid the same, because as you know the Chief Justice gets substantially more than any other judge.
No, don't answer that.
Well, why can I?
No, come, Steve.
No, I think JJ's suggestion is good, that one needs to wait and then we see which way it lies, which way the Constitutional Court finds, and we have the various options available. I also like Dean's suggestion to keep the ad hominem side as well, should the Court not rule on that. That's a third possibility as well. Okay. I think it's important for us to avail ourselves Thursday, Friday, Saturday for possibly getting together briefly. I understand now why Tuesday is such an important date. It will be very difficult to finalise everything on Tuesday with printing it with Monday. We need to have some idea where we're going to by Saturday at the late with the printers and everything. So, Chair, I fully support that. And then we can see which way we're going to go, depending on which way the Court rules. So I'm in support of that. Thank you, Chair.
Right.
Chair,
maybe
just
an
addition,
can I? Yes, we may first need to Mr. Jeffrey and then you, Mr. Scassone.
Yeah, we may need to vote on Monday, but we definitely need to have done all our preparatory work beforehand so we know what we're voting on.
Which may need a suspension of the 3-day rule.
Yes, will have to be suspended,
right.
Yeah.
Just so that honourable members and parties are aware of that.
Already
okay, fine. Mr. Scassone?
No, I just wanted to bring the attention of this House that I've called the Court, the Registrar, the Justices are meeting tomorrow at 1 o'clock. in a conference. What they do, they go and read separately and come and meet in a conference, deliberate, then start the process of reading a judgment. So there's tomorrow afternoon you'll be knowing. It will be the registrar, it will be certain when I would like to get the judgment. So
that's fine. Right. I said to someone in the break that unfortunately we are hostages. We are. We must acknowledge that, and so it's the wise thing we're doing. It's just the wise thing. That's all. Yeah. That's what I meant. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. All right. Honourable members, thank you very much. I sense that we already have deliberated on the bill. Yeah. And all we have to do is wait for the powers that be to hand down. Yes, they will.